You're listening to another episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview with Josh Salzman, Josh takes us through an experience that rocked his world in earthquake-like destruction. And I think he's still emotionally walking through the rubble, as you could kind of tell from the tone in his voice. In our previous 9 co-hosted episodes, Josh takes us on his wild ride as he works with worldwide celebrities and athletes. In the first part, the subject matter is a departure from our past. He speaks to a family tragedy and how he works through it. The second part's more in lockstep with previous episodes, as Josh shares a story about a one-legged field goal kicker that almost got him kicked off the football team. Without further ado, here's my buddy Josh. Welcome back to the podcast. It's always great to talk to you, and we haven't done this in several months, and we'll talk more about why we haven't, but welcome back.
He sounds like my girlfriend right now, Rich.
You what?
He sounds like my girlfriend saying that.
I'm sorry. I haven't seen you in a while, but there's a reason for it, honey. Look, I've had the pleasure of co-podcasting with you in 9 out of my last 82 episodes. And I would say some of our episodes are the top listened to episodes because people are interested in listening to some of the crazy, stupid shit that we've done and some of our ideas also. So some of the episodes we've touched upon are like some of your client experiences: Angelina Jolie, Kate Winslet, Sir Kenneth Branagh, Sir Paul McCartney, Sarah, Duchess of York, Ernie Els, all of these very interesting stories, not just the fact that you train them, that you had very interesting experiences with them, as well as a dead Nazi, which, by the way, that episode killed. That episode.
Yeah, let's not forget the dead Nazi.
Never forget the dead Nazi. You know, we've also talked about some of your experiments with psychedelics at a young age. And then some of your experiments while you're still training people at a young age, which I found fascinating, and so did our listening audience. We also touched upon your early age at Union College, Israel, London, your marriage, 5 children, and then a divorce. When we spoke at the end of last year, you had shared some devastating news with me. And when we were talking about it, we both said, look, we can't, this is not the time to talk about this in a podcast. Let's give it a little time and see where things shake out. And then we spoke again maybe a few weeks ago, and we're like, okay, this is probably the time. More time has gone by. You could talk about it. You know more. And you've also dealt with the 5 stages of grief as well. So, so let me turn it over, and why don't you share with our listeners that experience that you had at the end of last year, and then, you know, subsequently what's happened in your life.
Okay, Rich. Well, it's great checking up. And before you, or you wouldn't get this feeling, but your listeners get the feeling of, oh my God, oh, that's so horrible. I'm over it, and I'm through the 5 stages, and I'm a better person for it. But I'm a better person because of having to go deeper into myself. So on October 2nd of this year, August of this year.
Now, this is last year, right? This is in 2021.
Last year. Yeah, 2021, the beginning of August. My oldest daughter, Francesca, the mother of my 2 grandchildren, Malachi, who's 1, and Gabriel, who's 2 now, had a breakdown. Yeah, had a postnatal depression. And she signed herself up. And the NHS is easier because she's already was on their list because of certain issues she had previously. She suffered with bipolar. And that's one of the reasons why it's great to be here. She signed herself up and checked herself into the hospital. Her partner at the time, a gentleman called Mohammed, who they weren't married, But they had a interesting relationship that I never really knew about until post this, all this trauma. I just accepted the fact that, you know, she got pregnant, went to see Gabrielle when she was born, met her partner, never met him before, as you do, you know. And I'm always very open to people, and I take people as I'm very transparent, like we are in these conversations. So she goes into the hospital in August 2021, beginning. He's freaking out because he's got two little children. And one's pretty much, you know, just before one, and one is, you know, they were one and two in October of that year, anyways, or December, surely, of last year, right? So on December 10th, Malachi was one, and December 20th, Gabrielle was two. So very young children. Now, he was freaking out, and he lives very, very much on the other side of town from where I was living. I'm in a new place now, but it very much took like 3 hours to get there and all that stuff. And I'd been seeing them all through the pandemic, so I'd been very much hands-on. My ex had been there a bunch, but during the pandemic, she didn't go up, but I did because I broke all the rules. You know, I still trained people. But having said this, at this crisis, I kept going up. First, I saw my daughter in hospital. Then I saw this guy, Mohammed, and I gave him my support twice a week. So between my clients, making a living, running a business, and obviously we had a big bill for Super Ray at the time. We have a lesser bill now because we built it, but the bill was about $10,000 a month, and I'm working by my hands by the hour to pay for everything and my rent and whatnot. You know, he was freaking out, and I was seeing him twice a week and helping him with the grandchildren, giving him money, giving him moral support. And so,
it's a lot to balance.
A lot of heavy duty clients, and some very new clients, which I'll tell you about in the next podcast, some very ones that are very relevant right now in the whole world's media. But having said all that, so what happened leading up, then October 2nd happened. And what happened was I was at the Super A studio in Fulham, London. So I was in town, and I got a call from my ex, or a missed call from my ex, and she left a voicemail that said something like, "You better call me." And then I got a voicemail from social services that said, "Could you please call us, Mr. Salzman?" But then I got a voicemail from the Harringay.
These are calls you don't want to get. Yeah.
You don't want to get. So I traced it back, and I spoke to the police, and they said, the father of your grandchildren was found dead, 39 years old, of a suspected heart attack. And he was alone for one day with your grandchildren. And if it wasn't for them crying and screaming, the neighbors wouldn't be alerted, and they busted down the door to get in. Yeah. So
your grandkids, like one and two.
Before they were one and two.
Before they were one and two, discover their father has had some kind of heart. They don't know heart problem. He just hit the ground, and now they can't talk to him. He's not doing anything. And they can't leave the place. They can't call. They don't know how to call on a phone. And no one else is there with them.
Well, they were crying. My Malachi, my youngest son, was trapped behind the television set. And he was screaming so much. He was fine physically. But the neighbors were alerted to it. And they called the police. And the police busted in. And the only reason I know this, because this is all also during the COVID period, you know, Omicron, and you're not, you know, things are really tough, is that through the Duchess of York, I know certain police people over the last 33 years that I've been working with her, and they made a couple calls, and I found out actually the person that was on the scene of the break-in, yeah? And he said he was found with his hands on his chest. Now, we found out he actually died, and I'm going to be very honest with you because I'm transparent, of a drug overdose.
Oh, geez, with the kids.
With the kids. So yeah. I never detected that. But having said all that, what happened was my sister, who is very, very much hands-on, but she's in Ottawa, not in Ottawa, Kingston, Ontario, as a professor at Queen's College, started, when I told her, she started rallying, you know, she said, well, the best thing to do to find out his relatives, because I asked him if he had relatives, and he said, no, I don't know anybody around here, was to put my name on his Facebook page. So what happened was within 7 days, I had 25 people from all over the world, Sierra Leone, where he originally came from, all over London, over the United States, 25 different people screaming down the phone at me going, oh, my God, he's dead. Ya Allah, ya Allah, that kind of stuff. Or they were Christian. So they're either Muslim or Christian. So there was a lot going on. And, you know, we were, and I was knee jerking everything, you know, not because I'm pretty steady, Rich. You know me for ages, right. You know. But when you get hit with like that, you got your children in care, right? They're brought into the social services over here.
Well, let me stop there a second. So you discover you can't get. If I remember our conversation, it's been a few months though. But when you discovered all of this, you actually couldn't see your grandchildren right away, right? Because social services had taken them, or is that wrong?
That's right. Social services had taken them because what happened was my ex wasn't on the scene at the time. She was away with her husband.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get a hold of anybody. And I was away with a client. So I couldn't take them. So what happened was they went right to social services. They first went to a hospital, then they went to social services. So what happens is, when social services are involved, which is rightly so, you know, they have to interview you before you can see them because they want to see if you're a bad grandpa or a good grandpa.
Right.
So you got to go through this whole process where you meet them at the contact center. There's this contact center in Haringey where they are and with their temporary foster care person now called the Maria Lou Center. And this is about, it was done by this famous woman that had a couple children in the States. And she found how difficult it was to raise them by herself. So they had this charitable organization and they named this center after her. And they're angels, these people. Some of the people in social services are pain in the butts and they're just pen pushers and doing their job in a crappy way. But some people like these ladies and men are just angels and they're doing it because they really believe in what they're doing.
Did you meet the first responders who went in and got the kids that were in social services?
No, they weren't social service.
The police came in and found the kids and then delivered the kids to social services, or they made an exchange some way?
They brought them to social services. They brought them to a hospital, then they brought them to social services. So there's a lot of trauma with the young guys, but they've gotten over it now. And they're doing very well. I mean, obviously, maybe long-term stuff, which leads into... So what happened was my sister was saying, look, the guy's Muslim, although part of his family's Christian, you got to wrap him in cloth. You got to find the body at the coroner's office. So the police told me where the coroner's office was, but in the pandemic, you can't go in the coroner's office. You can't recognize the body. You can't. So I went all over London, basically, to find this body that I couldn't find.
Wow.
And then he went into this. Then they did this autopsy, which only came out like 12 weeks later, what he died of, right? And I had come to the place, and first of all, I love the guy. I don't do things in half measures. So I wasn't like, oh, you know, I'm not happy my daughter married this guy or had babies with this guy. I embraced him like he was my family, you know, totally. I was transparent to him. He wasn't obviously that transparent with me. And he had some issues that I found out about from the past that he didn't want anybody to know about. So he was a hurting soul.
Yeah.
But I don't want a narrative when my grandchildren get old enough to know about their dad. But at the time, what happened to me was I was very stressed out because I was getting information from my sister. I was getting told to do from other people, do this, do that. You should do this. You should do that. And when you're like that, you go into a stage of like kind of like high adrenaline and high cortisol levels. And so I had an evening about a month after this was all coming down when I had absorbed everything. But I'm still trying to carry on, still trying to see my grandchildren. And I had an evening where all of a sudden I ate too much, although I eat really well, and I started feeling, which was indigestion. I thought I was having a heart attack. So I had my hands on my chest, and I'm thinking, I'm alone by myself here. No, I don't live with anybody. I'm thinking, flipping hell, I'm going to fucking die the way he died.
So it's like an anxiety attack.
Oh, a high anxiety attack, but it was indigestion. But I kind of put it at there. And the interesting thing was I started thinking about, because what this does, when you get something like this, all your meditation, all your exercise, all your philosophies, all your Taoism, Judaism, and whatever you want to call it, all mixed into one, isn't helping. And,
you know, it's like what Mike Tyson, it reminds me, like Mike Tyson says, you could have all of the greatest strategies in the world till you get hit in the face. And what you happened to you is you just got hit in the face with all of this.
Well,
wait, all at one
wait
time.
To put it. Put it, Rich. Way to put it. And so what this guy was talking about was Dr. Gabor Mate, and any of your readers can Google him and find out what he's about. All trauma comes back to the womb, and you receive the cortisol levels of your mom. And in his case, when the Nazis are coming in and you're Jewish and hungry, there's going to be a lot of cortisol coming in. So he basically was traumatized himself. And when you're a child, what he said was, you can't run, you can't hide, you can't tell people to fuck off, you can't beat anyone up, you just have to have coping mechanisms. And that's what he believes, that most learning disorders And a lot of diseases start because people are just trying to cope in a short-term basis that helps them, but the long-term basis doesn't help. You know, as a kid, you just want to look away. You don't want to know. So the child goes to school and he still wants to look away, but he learned that when he saw trauma. Now, post the 2008 car industry problems, there's more people in Michigan, young people that were born in 2008, that have asthma than any other part of the United States. Why? Because they're going when their parents are fighting and arguing over financial issues, right? Or problems. And so it isn't a social, it's not, it bypasses all socioeconomic situations because children don't want to be saying anything because they're freaking out. So they have asthma. And so what do they give people for asthma? They give stuff that makes you have asthma more. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, and until people get to the root of the problem, they never get really cured. They're just treating their symptoms. And he also says that sometimes people that come from trauma say yes too much. And the people that say yes too much and don't say no or don't put up boundaries actually get ill more than any other people. People that don't listen to their gut instincts or listen to their gut actually can get, you know, cancers because they keep acquiescing to their ex-wife or to their to business associates. And they don't say, no, that isn't working. They just say yes. And they know it isn't working. And they're trying to make sense of it. And it produces a lot of cortisol and anxiety because you're trying to make your brain believe what your gut's telling you isn't right. Cortisol long-term can affect every aspect of your health and all your hormones and all your insulin levels and everything else, besides the fact it'll sleep deprive you and everything else. And it'll make you want to dampen it down with things like alcohol or harder drugs. Because if you look at most people that are on the streets, in this case, Vancouver, where he treats a lot of addicts, they're just covering pain up. They're in pain. We lock people up that have pain. Yeah.
So you think Mohammed was in pain? You think that kind of led to his drug use? Yeah. So he had skeletons in his closet, and his way of dealing with that was medicate himself, and he went too far.
Yeah, I think, but also I don't think he did it all the time, but I think with what he was dealing with in his life, with having two children and thinking that because he was working at the time, he was doing stuff. I think what he had is he saw his life going someplace. Then all of a sudden, you know, Francesca goes into my daughter goes in the hospital and he decides that his life isn't going someplace.
That was a trigger.
Yeah, it was a trigger. And you know, talk about triggers. When people say that person pisses me off or that person is a trigger. A trigger is a trigger, but we have the bullets. And this is why when we first started talking about Super A in the sense of disciplines, this is why it's so important, like what you did today, Rich, to go for your swim, to take care of yourself, to kind of do your thing, to eat right, whatever you do, intermittent fasting, I don't know how you do your thing, that there's disciplines that you do every day that get you prepared for stuff. Because when you get hit with something like that, if I wasn't into disciplines as a general rule, I would have been dead. I'm probably stronger than I've ever been in like 30 years. I mean that. I really do. And that's because I even more now get up earlier and I go to bed earlier and I strength train smarter and I stretch more. And I don't look at my phone for the first 2 hours of my early morning moving. I make notes. Then you're not, or a business deal that you're ready to walk. Because don't forget, Rich, I've never been in a salary situation. I've had little contracts, but I have to negotiate with each individual client and train them in a bespoke manner and deal with them in a certain way. Like you saw that Italian guy that I sing to as a joke, and he loves it. We kick off. So, you know, you got to go with, and if you're a football player or a wrestler or a tennis player or a golfer, you know, golfers are the most selfish fuckers I've ever seen in my life, man. They do exactly what they need to do. And Justin Rose, who I met his psych coach a couple of years ago, he didn't win a U.S. Open until he got a little bit more selfish. He was too selfless. And then he wins the U.S. Open.
Yeah, so you're starting to see that now with that Saudi PIF versus the PGA. And it's really interesting talking about, you know, selfish, how each of the players have chosen. They've looked at all the trade-offs, and they've now, because of the Phil Mickelson incident where he was a little too outspoken, or he was outspoken. I'm not sure how to weigh that yet, but he was outspoken. And then all the other players, you know, in fear of being penalized by the PGA, all sided with the PGA. and, you know, had all their publicists make their statements like, you know, this is the, you know, the PGA has given me my life. I owe everything to, you know, all this crap. Well, the PGA just basically said, if you go to the PIF, Saudi PIF, there's a really good chance you'll never play here again. And so
I said that one, my own experience with Phil Mickelson, and I always had a nice relationship with him, and Bones was his caddy for years. I'd always say, yeah, hey, how you doing, guys? This was when I was on tour 15 years ago. So I didn't have any problems with anybody because I came from a different avenue. But I'd say this, that I think in back to the, we originally started when we weren't on air about Putin and stuff. I think people go with power and they'll subjugate or they'll compromise their beliefs and values if they have any. Yeah. And with me, if I'm going to do a really good job with my clientele, whether it's the Duchess of York or, you know, some of these actors that I work with now that are quite famous that I can't mention one in particular that everybody would know, I just started with this guy and I'm seeing great results. I have to be honest with what I'm saying. I have to say what I'm thinking and think what I'm saying. I have to be transparent because if I'm not, I won't do my job because then they can lie to me and they can like tell not the truth. So what I say to people is how I believe. And when I was with Ernie, there was a couple instances where I said my truth and everybody in the posse or the entourage looked at me like, you're going to get fucking fired right now because you can't say your truth. And I said, well, fuck, I'm going to say it. You might not like what I'm going to hear, but I'm going to say it.
So if a woman asks you, does she look fat in this dress? What do you say?
Do I look fat?
No.
Okay, I accept that. When Janice asked me and I said no, she took that to mean that I was calling her a cow.
Okay, walk us through it, honey. Walk us through it.
Okay, well, Janice said, hi, do I look fat today? And I looked at her.
Whoa. You looked at her? You never look. You just answer. It's like a reflex. Do I look fat? No. Is she prettier than I am? No. Does size matter?
No.
And it works both ways.
I think that is a different set of, when you're talking that way, it's a different set of cards. But I would say
Well, it's not really,
you allow your, well, vice versa. Because if I was in front of a lady that I was with and she was seeing me get fatter and I was saying, don't I look good in this, you know, Speedo outfit? And they told me, oh, you look fucking brilliant. Then you might as well be one of these women that are telling Putin that he looks good on a horse with his shirt off. He looks like a fucking pedophile.
Right.
What are you talking about?
I like having a partner that is honest. Like when I like during COVID, this COVID time, and particularly when I got it in January, you just get tired. You get these headaches. You're tired. You know, thank God it wasn't the, you know, SARS, you know, into my lungs or anything. But he just wipes you out. And so what do you do? What do I do? I didn't feel like working out. I couldn't play golf. So I just started eating. It gave me satisfaction, right? And it was all bad shit. So now, like the week or so ago, I'm talking to Tracy and I said something about, you know, I think I really have to go on a diet. Now, in the past, I've known other people that would have said, no, you're fine. She's just straight up. Hey, if that's what you think you got to do, I'll help you do it. That was her way of saying, yes, you have gained weight. You have we all do it. But it's like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you that everything's great when everything's not great.
Well, otherwise you lose your street cred. And I think you got to carry it over to a certain extent with people you love. You have to kind of. You can, and even with clients of mine, for instance, a client will say, let me show you my card from the gym, what I've done in the gym. And they show me a card. I said, no, look in the fucking mirror. There's your card. You know what I mean?
Yeah, look in the mirror. Card. Everybody knows. Everybody knows how much they're putting into themselves, whatever that self-help is. It could be fitness. It could be nutrition. It could be how you treat others. I think we all know where we are. And sometimes you get allured into the fact that you're better than you're doing better than you think you're, or you're doing worse than you think you're doing until others bring it up to you. Those are the people you really have to thank in life. I think anybody who says something about my behavior when it's might be sideways, those are my true friends because maybe it has an impact on them, but also they're more like, you could be better.
Okay. Well, look at John Wooden, the famous basketball coach. He had this line that used to say to people, if you're the right mentor for a person, if you coach people the right way, you won't make a player have resentment. Yeah. you'll coach them the right way. We won't call them out in front of their other players like a lot of coaches do and say, he fucked up on this play in front of the whole world. Like, there's a couple football coaches and soccer coaches over here, like Mourinho, who is very famous for bringing a few people to the Champions League. But what he'll do when he does a press conference, he'll go, that player played terrible. You know, he wasn't motivated. Well, that's your fucking problem, mate. You're making $8 million a fucking, you know, month. Well, 8 million pounds a year to motivate him. It's your job. You shouldn't throw him under the bus. What John Wooden would do, he would work with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Lew Alcindor at the time, or work with another white guy from Indiana. And he'd always be able to give people, because he was a teacher first, an English teacher first, he'd teach them. He'd make sure that they were a better person rather than just a better basketball player. And he'd make sure the player realized that if he played or the best he could, and they win or lost, that was fine. There was no need to cry, or there was no need. If you did the best you can, then you have nothing to feel bad about. And this is where he was a good mentor, because that's what I try to do to my clients, where you can critique them and they feel they're doing it because you want them to be better, not because you're trying to get a one-up on them.
Hey, Josh just tells it like he sees it. It's refreshing, right? I play golf with these guys that are just straight up about most everything. So I'm playing with a character I call Billy the Kid the other day and having what I consider to be my worst round in 30 years. It happens. You think you're doing everything right, your pre-shot routine, your alignment, your setup right before you swing the club. Then you take the club back and something just doesn't feel right. So now you hit your downswing and you hit the ball. It just doesn't feel right. The result? Horrible hook left. Push right into bunker land. The next thing you know, you're making the turn 11 strokes over your average front nine. So now what do? You make adjustments and your playing partners almost have to look away every time you hit the ball. They're just hoping you get it back in play. So I get to this par 3, 95 yards over marsh, and I would say 95% of the time I'm hitting it somewhere on the green. But I'm sure which club to use. So I pick up this club that I tend to hit around 95 yards, and I hit it. It doesn't feel right. It goes halfway across the marsh and then dives into the thick like an osprey diving for fish. So out of frustration, I just say, God, I should have used a different club. And without pause, Billy the Kid just looks at me and goes, you mean anything other than your 35-yard club? Honesty. Brutal honesty. It's a rare and highly skilled talent. And my buddy Josh is blessed with it. He's earned it through his own personal achievements, but also with the results that he gets from his clients. Who can forget how Angelina Jolie looked and acted in Tomb Raider? She worked hard for that body, and Josh helped her by taking her there through focus on exercise and diet and brutal honesty about the things she needed to do. She worked hard for it. I applaud his courage in sharing this story about one of the most traumatic life incidences he's ever experienced. Yeah, and so the second part of this interview is departure from that. Josh and I get on a series of other topics, one of which is a story that he tells about going to try and make a buddy of his feel better in the hospital. The guy had just had open heart surgery. And the one thing that Josh was told is you just can't make him laugh. But that doesn't stop Josh. Josh tells him this story, a true story about when he played football for Union College against Hamilton College, one of the worst recorded colleges that year. It's actually in Sports Illustrated. These guys hadn't won in like 3 years. Now they got to face this team. And on the team, they have a one-armed, one-legged kicker. And the coach gives Josh one assignment. Josh is on the kickoff return team. Once the ball's kicked, Josh's assignment is to block and take out the kicker. In this situation, it was the one-armed, one-legged kicker. So I invite you back to listen to the second part of this interview. Thanks for staying and listening. You've been listening to an episode from Tales from the First Tee. I'm your host, Rich Easton, telling tales from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. Talk to you soon.